People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. Now let me tell you about my guest. In 2003, without a body and against police evidence, he was wrongly convicted of drowning a fish poacher and spent 10 harrowing years under horrendous conditions in Zimbabwe's prisons during Mugabe's rule. He's written about being subjected to conditions most people would find unbearable, having to draw on his inner resources and strengths to endure the unimaginable. And in the process, he says he not only developed a life-saving resilience, but also an empathy and keen desire to help his fellow inmates. His book is called Beating Chains, and his name is Rusty Labuschagne. Rusty, welcome. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Rodney.
It sounds as though you have quite a story to tell.
I do.
And I'm going to make sure you tell it. But let's just try and do it sort of chronologically. Tell me a little bit, if we go back a few decades. I see that you grew up in Zimbabwe. Is that where you did develop this love of the outdoors? Because that's very important to you, isn't it, the outdoors?
Yes. I'm a fourth-generation Zimbabwean from a cattle ranching background and developed my love for the wildlife there. And got into the wildlife industry as a result of my love for conservation and wildlife. Yeah.
Gosh, it really was your life, the
yes,
whole outdoor
absolutely.
Thing.
Yeah.
And Rusty, I see that you grew up in Rhodesia, well, Zimbabwe as is now. So let's go back a few decades. Is this where you developed your great love of the outdoors?
It is, Rodney. I am a fourth generation Zimbabwean from a cattle ranching background. And obviously, in those days, there was no computers, cell phones, and PlayStations and stuff here, and no crime. So it was a very free, beautiful upbringing that sadly we've lost today. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it was all conservation and wildlife orientated, and that's where I developed my love for the wild. But I just wanted to bring up the hardships also of those years, where living so far away from town, to boarding school 200 kilometers away at 6 years old.
My goodness.
And when you think about that today, it's like almost unheard of. And then obviously the war in Rhodesia, that was 12 years, which ended in 1980, the year I left school. So there were hardships all the way through. And then I went into the wildlife industry, safari industry, with my love for conservation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it was part of that. It ended up
with the catastrophe.
Yeah.
But now you speak of your success as a businessman. You were literally flying high, apparently. I mean, you were pretty well at the top of your game, weren't you,
when
this happened?
I had developed a... just bearing in mind that we grew up really poor. So I lost my dad when I was 12, so that was another big hardship in my life. And then went into the safari industry, took a lot of chances, borrowed a lot of money, and I was just very ambitious and driven. I ended up buying a 40,000-acre cattle ranch with 820 head of cattle. I had a water well drilling machine, and then my safari business had 5 safari camps. Then I had a fishing resort on Lake Kariba.
Good grief.
So, yeah, and I was flying my own aircraft. So,
oh, you were literally flying?
Yes, I was. Uh-huh. I had my own aircraft that I flew. And
as part of the company?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, I was. It's a lesson that I would like to point out to listeners that I was flying high, feeling that I was bulletproof and above everything, not above the law, just a little bit arrogant to life. And it was all about me and my empire. And now that I've been through what I've been through, I've come out and it's about the people in my life and my journey, not my assets and wealth alone. And I think we lose sight of all that when we get too tangled up in wanting too much,
mm-hmm.
and concentrating on what we haven't got instead of being grateful for what we have.
Because as a result of this experience and this book, you've become something of a public speaker as well. You're a motivational speaker, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I speak to a lot of corporates all around Southern Africa, and it's really taking off. It's mm-hmm. it's fantastic.
Because I saw a couple of video clips with you talking about your experience. And yeah. I mean, one of the ones I saw was only 5 minutes long, but it sort of gives you an idea of the horror you experienced that we cannot possibly imagine
exactly.
what you went through. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
And have you found, I mean, are you in demand as a public speaker as a result
yes,
of this?
It's going very well.
Yeah, good.
I'm very happy to say I've got a fantastic speaking bureau agency, Unique Speaker Bureau, and they've really promoted me a lot.
Is that now your job since you've...
It is. That's what I do.
Okay, well, good for you.
And I've written the book, and the book is really... I mean, it's only a month old now, and it's really taking off.
Okay, well, I'm going to talk now about the book and how this catastrophe occurred. But before we do that, let's just take a piece of music, your first piece of music, so we can relax a while. And then I want you to tell me about this harrowing experience, this catastrophe. But what's your first choice, Rusty?
I would like Blowing in the Wind by Bob Dylan.
For any special reason?
Just his voice and the basic lyrics give you a feeling of real freedom that we've lost, I feel. You know, I feel.
Even those of us who are allegedly free.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a thought, eh? Okay, here's Bob Dylan.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Listen, how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing. How many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Listen, how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Listen, how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Listen, how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Listen, how many years must one man have before he can hear people cry? Listen, how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing.
That was Bob Dylan. And what was that piece called, Rusty?
Blowing in the Wind.
Blowing in the Wind. It was the first choice of my guest, Rusty Labuschagne, whose book has just been published called Beating Chains, about a horrendous 10 years in a Zimbabwean prison, all because of being apparently, Rusty, charged with something you didn't do. But we're going to find out about that, because you spoke about you were high-flying, literally in your aeroplane, with your business, with your safari company. And then catastrophe struck at the height of all this. Tell us about that day. Apparently it started off as a simple boating trip.
Yeah, a group of us, friends of mine that I took as guests to my fishing resort. And during the trip, just to bear in mind the history behind it, there was a fishing cooperative not far from my fishing resort. And the resort is in a breeding area for the fish. So it's a no netting area. And the fishing resort, which are like 80, 90 people, I mean the fishing cooperative, kept on netting inside the breeding area. So there was and I was the only one when I'd fly in my plane. My manager didn't want to get too involved in the anti-poaching side. So I was the only one cutting the nets. And so whenever I came in there, there was conflict between the cooperative and me. And it was during the land invasion time.
Yes.
So it was just... It was in December 2000, so it was like 10 months after it started. So it was in full swing, and the justice system had started falling apart at that time. Obviously, white farmers getting killed and all that stuff. So it flowed over into the masses. And the cooperative decided that they were going to teach me a lesson, basically. And I saw two of them. There were two guys in my boat. We had gone out tiger fishing on the lake, and we left the other guys bream fishing in the river. On our way back, we spotted two fish poachers in a steel boat who immediately, upon seeing us, started paddling hastily for the shore in an effort to get away from us. And knowing they were known poachers, I drove my boat towards them to scare them off, and the wake of my boat tilted their boat, causing them to jump out into the water. And my whole intention was to give them a fright. Because it was 2 hours to the nearest police station. It was after 5 in the evening, so it would have taken me into 9 in the evening to take them in. And the water was about 1.5 meters deep, and they were about 3 meters from the shore, and they soon scrambled to dry land, and then we watched as they ran away into the bush, thinking nothing more of it. The following day, the police arrived and accused us of drowning one of those poachers. And to cut a long story short, I was framed by the poacher, the police, and the courts in an ugly political, it got very political, conspiracy, and sentenced to 15 years in prison.
But what about the body? Where did they find the body?
It was against police evidence, without a body, and against police, and on presumptions. I was convicted of drowning that poacher. That's still alive in Zambia today, and it's a well-known fact in that area.
Good grief.
So it got very ugly.
Was there a prolonged trial and all that, or was it just quick
put you
in prison?
The trial was 2.5 years later. I was on bail that whole time, but then it got there was a judge in Zimbabwe that tried to help me. He got thrown in prison, and he wasn't impeached or anything, Justice Paradza. And then he absconded to New Zealand. And when he was thrown in prison, the BBC, Sky News, and CNN were all in Zimbabwe at that time reporting the land grab. And that was in January 2003, when I was still free.
Right. And out on bail you were?
Yeah, I was on bail, pending... Yeah.
Pending the trial?
Yeah, pending judgment. It was after judgment.
Oh, so the trial had taken
trial,
place.
Yeah, pending judgment. And when he walked out, all those media were waiting for him. So he slandered the president, the minister of justice, and the whole justice system in every international paper. And my name was attached to every article. Then there was a war between the president and the judge. And the next minute, the judge was thrown in prison. And then I was warned that unless you're guilty, they can't prosecute the judge, and there's a war between the judge and the president. And they advised me to get out of the country. Now, it's like me telling you, Rodney, leave Cape Town, leave South Africa, and never come back. Your family, your friends, everything you worked your whole life for, you must run away, and you're guilty. So, I mean, even if I knew what was going to happen, people often ask me that, would you have run? And I want to point out to listeners that a reputation is more valuable than anything, and it takes such a long time to build. And I still have my reputation. I lost 10 years of my life, and when I look back, and just to give you an idea, you know, every day we learn something.
Yes.
When you've got 10 years of learning nothing except life lessons on survival, big chunk taken away with the way technology has advanced. So when I got out, it was like a new world completely. Gosh.
Did you have any idea during the trial and before judgment that they were going to find you guilty regardless?
No. So there's no evidence, and they made such a mess of the trial. Contradictions between the witnesses. And I could see their side. They were told what to say.
As so you said, it was political.
Yeah. So when you get someone from the middle of nowhere and you start questioning him on details on how much blood was supposed to be there and how long, how tall the tree was sticking out the water, certain details, they all messed it up. Every single witness had a different amount of blood, where it was, how tall the tree was, and where the paddle was found, the paddle I was supposed to have beaten the guy with, where that was found, who found it, and every single one was different. Gosh. But they just ignored the whole lot.
So were you supposed to have beaten him up with a paddle and then paddle, left him to drown?
Yeah.
That was the story they created.
Yeah, and then he was supposed to have swum to a tree, and I ran over him with a boat. All rubbish.
And
yeah.
So when the verdict was delivered of guilty, you must have been, well, shocked.
You have no idea of
can you remember
the feeling
that moment?
I can, like yesterday. And it's something that you never forget.
Yeah.
You know? And I think being in the position I was in, I was always the one everyone turned to for support in my family and my friends and stuff. So when that happens to you, they are more broken than you. I mean, the courtroom was packed.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, my sisters and all my friends and everyone around me, broken, crying and crowded around me. And now I have to remain strong.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, because if I break down, then you can only imagine. Mm-hmm. But the thought of them, you know, I was engaged to be married that year to a young girl as well. And the thought of them going home and telling my children
who
were waiting at home, that for me was the most difficult part. Yeah, you know, just thinking what they, I mean, I always had this inner fear of going to prison and seeing those people on the side of the road cleaning in the public places and in their white uniforms. It was always a hell of a fear for me. So now when you're in amongst them. And another huge thing for me, Rodney, and that people don't understand is the humiliation you go through from being somebody in society. And when I say somebody, I was making donations regularly to old age homes, orphanages, and certain charities. So when you're now in handcuffs and leg irons on Main Street during rush hour, walking out of the High Court in front of everyone, the humiliation is something else. And then I had to climb into the back of a truck that was about the steps were like 3 feet, about a meter above the ground, and only one step between. Now, in leg irons and handcuffs, you can only hold one rail because your hands are cuffed on one side of the door. Mm. And then you have to leapfrog onto the first step, and you're off balance. And I kept on falling. And everyone, all the guards just couldn't stop laughing. No one would help me. And you don't understand the humiliation of that. Mm. And then it got worse. I mean, when I got to prison, the first thing they make you strip naked when you... So you check in and everything. They remove the handcuffs and leg irons. Then they walk you to the exercise yard wall, which is a massive 20-foot white wall. And there's huge doors leading into that. And when you get to the door, they remove all your... Well, you take all your clothes off. So you walk in stark naked. And same in the army. Mm. It's like it breaking you.
Yeah, breaking you, absolutely.
Yeah, so you walk in. There were 1,000 guys in there. I was the only white guy. And you walk in and you crouch down beside four guards. So you're escorted by two people in. You crouch down and then they question you for what seemed like forever about family, business, my crime, where I came from and everything. Mm. And then finally they issue you with a standard white short-sleeve shirt and a pair of drawstring white shorts. And then they escorted me up to my cell. And the cell was 13 meters long by 3 meters wide. We were 78 guys in there.
Good grief.
So everybody had 33 centimeters of space marked out on the walls in chalk. That was your space. And
so no beds?
No beds. There's no furniture whatsoever in the prison. There's no tables, chairs, cupboards, beds, nothing. Just rows of filthy folded blankets and well-used water bottles on bare concrete floors. That's it. And then the lice was another issue. All the blankets, you got 3 blankets. And they were lice-ridden, the whole place. And I never knew, I'd never known what lice were. Mm. Well, I knew what they were, but I'd never seen one. Mm. And when they bite you day and night, because they get into your clothes and everything, and they're everywhere. They're on the walls, on all the blankets, in your hair, everywhere. And they bite you day and night. It never goes away. And it drives you nuts. Anyway, when it was time to sleep, the cell was 3 meters wide. So you lie with your legs all crossing over the middle and you all face the same direction. Otherwise, you can't fit. You only have 33 centimeters. So you pack like sardines and you all face the same direction. Mm. When you turn over, you all turn over together. And the guys needing the toilet at night couldn't help but tremble you on the way to the toilet. Mm. In one corner was a cement block, 1 meter square, with a stainless steel bowl in the middle for the toilet, open for everyone to see. And then you were only allowed one set of clothing that you were given on the first day at any one time. There's no other clothing allowed. And you had to wash your clothes in the cell toilet at night wearing a blanket, then hang them on the walls with smuggled book staples to dry by the next morning. And then every 6 months, you got a change of clothing. But they would take the others away, otherwise guards would sell the new clothes and keep the old one. Mm. So you're only ever allowed one set of clothing at any one time.
That you have to wear day and night.
the whole time. That's it. There's only
not
one
a beautiful
clothing.
Pair of pajamas to get into bed. No. Let's just pause for a moment and try and take some of that in, Rusty, okay, while we have your next piece of music, because then, okay, I mean, it's sort of traumatic even listening to you with a story in the prison, and I know there's a lot more to talk about there as well.
Absolutely.
So what is your second choice?
My second choice is When I'm Back on My Feet Again by Michael Bolton.
I think the title says it all, doesn't it? As
far as the lyrics of the song, they make your hair stand up.
Okay.
Gonna break these chains around me. Gonna learn to fly again. Maybe hard, but I'll do it. When I'm back on my feet again, soon these tears will all be drying. Soon these eyes will see the sun. Might take time, but I'll see. When I'm back on my feet again, when I'm back on my feet again, I'll walk proud down the street again, and they'll all look at me again. They'll see that I'm strong. Gonna hear the children laughing. Gonna hear the voice of sin. Won't be long till I hear them. When I'm back on my feet again, I'm gonna feel the sweet light of heaven shining down, it's light on me. One sweet day, I will feel it. When I'm back on my feet again, when I'm back.
Was Michael Bolton, and it was called When I'm Back on My Feet, an appropriate song for my guest here, whose name is Rusty Labuschagne. He's talking about being incarcerated in a Zimbabwean prison for 10 horrendous years, and he's written about it in a book called Beating Chains, and that is what we're talking about. Rather a horrifying story, but interestingly, I just said to Rusty now about a nightmare of all this building that's going on here at Artscape, and he said, you don't know what a nightmare is. So I can absolutely understand. So here you are, now you started your, were you taken to prison immediately after the sentence on
Yeah.
And that's when all this happened with your...
Naked.
So what did you sleep on? Do they give you blankets?
On the floor.
On the floor.
Now you folded, you got three...
Three blankets.
Worn out, lice-ridden blankets.
Yeah.
And you took two of them and folded them several times to fit your 33 centimeter space as cushioning against the cold concrete floor.
Mm.
And then covered yourself with the third one.
Gosh. Yeah. And what about ablutions? If you want to have a glass of water, use the
toilet. There's no basins or taps in the cells. So that's why there's water bottles. So any water that you need, you take it in a water bottle.
Where do you get the water from?
From the taps outside of the cells.
Outside, okay.
Yeah.
So everything had to be done in this bowl.
In the
cleaning
toilet.
Your teeth in the toilet bowl.
Yeah, everything.
Doing the laundry.
Yeah.
And what were the other inmates like? Was that part of the horror, or they...
Just like in society, obviously that's dregs of society, supposedly. You get, and there are a lot of innocent guys in there. I wasn't alone. And you get good guys, and you get guys you never want to see out of that place.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, being the only white guy in there, I feel that I benefited more. I just had a lot more respect. Obviously, they knew that it was a successful businessman coming to prison. So a lot of guys attached themselves to you for benefits that may spill off. They've got nothing in there.
Mm.
And something else that people need to understand, when you go in there, you walk in naked, they control what you eat, what you drink, what you hear, what you say, what you read, what you write, everything is controlled. No communication whatsoever. There's no radio, no TV, nothing. So you have no, there's no watches, there's no mirrors. You have no idea what the time is and what's going on outside. And you're allowed a visitor, one person every 2 weeks. It's supposed to be 15 minutes, but it ends up about 8 to 10 minutes, sometimes 4 minutes. That's it. Otherwise, you have no idea what's going on.
Did you have visitors? Were you able to have visitors?
Yeah, every 2 weeks.
I think in your book, your sister, or
Lynn
played a fairly major... She was like a lifeline for you.
Absolutely. So, something I didn't mention to you. So, obviously, during the land invasion period, the farms were all taken, and it's the agricultural-based economy in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
And then food started running short. So by 2003, April 2003, I went inside. By then, there was a serious food shortage. So in the first year, I witnessed about 200 people die, mainly from malnutrition. There was no food. TB was unbelievable. There were over 100 people on TB treatment. And obviously when there's no food, because it was one meal a day, and it's just pup and boiled cabbage or sugar beans. There's no fruit, there's no veggies, there's no meat, nothing. All you get is pup and either cabbage.
Once a day?
Once a day. Yeah.
Do you, and tea and coffee?
In the first prison in the beginning, for about 2 months, we got tea. And then after that, it was a thing of the past, yeah.
And during the day, what did you do when you got up in the morning? Could you go out of the cell?
In the first prison, because I was in Kami Maximum Security for 1 year. And then there, we were locked up for 16 hours a day. So 3 o'clock every day, you locked up, and you unlocked at 6 in the morning. And I thought that was tough. Those were good times. So during the day, you know, just dust. Something else that you need to, that needs to be mentioned is, it was built in 1956. All the ablution pipes on the side of the building all leaked, and a lot of them had cutting torch panels cut out of them to clear blockages from years gone by. And then obviously it's cast iron pipes, so they just wrapped blankets around there to stop the sewage, and it just infested with maggots, the whole thing. And then no toilets flushed in any prison. They're just water. Every time you finished on the toilet, and this is something I need to mention, which is horrific, is no toilets flushed, and you weren't allowed to use the ablutions during the night for hygiene purposes. So in the morning when you unlocked, now you locked up from 3 in the afternoon until 6 in the morning. So at 6 in the morning, everyone is rushing for the toilet. And only the big cells on the top floor, it was a three-story building, the ground floor, first floor, second floor. And the top floor were the big cells. The first and second floor were single cells that had three guys and five-man cells that had between 12 and 13 guys in each one. So every single cell was packed. But the bottom cells, the small ones, had no toilets. So they used five-liter containers cut off at the top as a toilet. But in the morning, when you wake up, everyone just rushes for the toilet. And there's guys with all their... The five-man cells had 20-liter containers. That was their toilet. And the single cells had five-liter container. And everyone goes to empty their excretion into urine into the toilets. And, mm-hmm. and all the other guys are busting, needing the toilet.
Yeah, yeah.
So these queues just line up waiting. And the humiliation of waiting in line to climb up there, there's no time to flush, the toilets don't flush, and you climb up on a cement block, there's no doors on any toilets, and you've got like 80 pairs of eyes glued on you waiting to finish. You talk about stage fright.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, dignity was non-existent.
No.
And the worst part of that was the toilet wasn't flushed, so it was just a mound that you're squatting over.
Yeah.
And another horrible side is when things got really tough, there was no toilet paper. But there were Bibles always issued by the churches. And you'd find pages of the Bible used
as toilet,
in the toilet
paper.
And that really tore into me deeply. And I'm a big Christian, so that for me was really tough.
Yeah. Rusty, let's have another piece of music. It's
okay.
Having a rather traumatic time here in the studio. But I think as we will hear... you've learnt about forgiveness, you've learnt about resilience and all that, but we'll come to in a moment. But what's your third piece of music?
Is Second Hand Heart by Ben Hanover.
And a reason for this?
Ben Hanover featuring Kelly Clarkson. I was engaged to be married that year.
Mm.
And when my fiance left me after 4 years, there were people dying all around me. There was no food. Chikurubi had run out of water. The Harare City, I haven't covered this, which is the last horror that I went through. Harare City ran out of water in 2005. So every prisoner was allocated one cup of water a day. Dirty orange city runoff water from a nearby dam carried by the foreign prisoners for 3 years.
So one for the day?
That was it. That was to drink, clean your teeth, wash your face, bath, everything. Every person, one cup a day for 3 years. So there was no water, no food, people dying everywhere. And then I got the Dear John letter. So my heart was broken. I mean, if I had to tell you, it was the lowest time ever in my life. Mm-hmm. I could handle go to prison, everything, but there's something about the person you share the intimate part of your life with.
Yes, of course.
That I think it's a rejection thing. I don't know what it, you know, your family and siblings and children will always be there.
Mm-hmm.
But the fear of losing that one person, I don't know why, you just hold on to it in there. So when you told that this is it, I mean, I was finished completely.
Yeah.
So the song is called Second Hand Heart, and I have a second hand heart now, but it's been taken by a very, very precious, beautiful lady in my life now, and the song is for her.
The light of the morning finds you sleeping in my bed. And it's not like the stories, it's never like what they said. I know who you want me to be, but I'm just not there yet. Yeah, the broken road's always been home, and it's so hard to forget. Wait for me now, will you wait for me now? I might think too much, drink too much, stay out too late. I know I'm just a fool, but I swear I can change. I can't steal you the stars, but I can give you this second-hand heart. All your friends think I'm hopeless, they don't understand that this imperfect start over again. It's been broken apart, but will you
That song was called Second Hand Heart by Ben Haino, and another choice of my guest, Rusty Labuschagne, who is sort of traumatizing us here with this extraordinary experience you had, Ben, which he's written about in a book called Beating Chains. And I'll give you details of the book in a moment. But did music, just listening to that, did music play a part? Were you allowed to listen to music in prison?
No music whatsoever.
Nothing?
No. I did in 2009... My sister sneaked me in when I moved to medium security prison, sneaked me in an iPod. Mm-hmm. And the music on that little thing brought more joy than you can ever imagine.
So we've reached a kind of low point now, because you said when you got the Dear John letter, you know, that was the lowest you'd ever felt.
Yeah.
And your story is a story about resilience and survival, but also, interestingly, about forgiveness.
Absolutely.
Which presumably has to do with your Christian side as well.
Yeah.
But it sounds as though, as angry and as hurt and as shattered as you were, you were able to forgive people, you were able to help others, and you developed, which is what you talk about when you do your motivational
stuff. So, Rodney, the one thing that I learned, and when I look at what Mandela used to say, that you have to be pushed to that level to really appreciate what forgiveness is. And the hatred, bitterness, revenge, and anger that I had built up was draining me daily. And I remember the exact moment walking in that prison exercise yard after about a year and just tired of all of that stuff that I was carrying. And then I'd question my faith a lot. You know, why me? What have I ever done? You know, then am I being protected by being put in there? I was dealing with high-powered guys. So a lot of questions go on in your mind. Mm-hmm. Why are you there? And I always told my kids, you know, everything happens for a reason. Mm. Now I had to walk my talk and try and accept there's no other way to get through there, that there's a reason for this. But after a year, I just said to myself, let the Lord take care of them and let me get through this road that's been put in front of me. And the weight lifted off from that, where I just pushed away. And, you know, if people aren't spiritual, it's like pushing aside things you can't control and just getting on with what's been put in front of you. And I learned in prison to live in the moment because the past is too painful and the future full of unkept promises. And I've carried that with me out now. So I don't bother what's happened because all that is only in your head. And the future, most of the time, stuff you worry about will never transpire. Mm-hmm. So I live in the moment now. I appreciate, obviously, having so much taken away. I just love every moment of my life.
It's interesting going right back to the beginning because you were saying you were a high flyer, remember?
Yeah.
And you sort of were untouchable. You were a successful businessman. You had a beautiful girlfriend.
Yeah.
Everything was going great.
Yeah.
And then it's just whipped away from you.
Absolutely.
Was your sentence 10 or 15 years?
15 years, and then they take off one third. But if you run away and they catch you or you misbehave in prison, they can put that one third on.
Okay.
But once you're released, you get a warrant of liberation and you're as free as anyone.
Can you remember that experience?
Absolutely.
Of being released? I mean, did you know a while before when you were going to be released?
I did. Yeah, I knew there was a bit of... they gave me 60 days and I appealed it for a cell phone misdemeanor. But didn't go to the courts or anything because if you add on anything onto a sentence, you've got to go through the court. So there was a bit of controversy at the end, but I was... Yeah, I was released after exactly 10 years and half a day.
And the day you left?
No, it was incredible. I had, obviously, the one thing we all miss from the bush is a braai. So I had 40 to 50 of my close friends, and we all had a braai at my house. And I've got a beautiful place in Buluwayo. It was really amazing.
Can you remember walking out and what you wore and who met you?
No, you actually wear the clothes you wore when you went in, when you walk out.
Even though it's 10 years ago.
Yeah, because they put them in a bag and they put away. And when you move from prison to prison, you put them back on, and then they put in another bag at the next prison. But I walked out into the arms of my gorgeous young daughter, and yeah, it was very special.
And very emotional. How long ago was that? When did you come out?
In 2013. April 2013, so it's 5.5 years ago.
Now, this book that you've written, did you start that when you came out, or did you write it in the prison?
I started... Believe it or not, I wrote the book on my smuggled cell phone in the prison.
Good
grief. Yeah, I had a friend of mine. I went to a farm prison for my last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And about 100 of us are carefully selected to run a farm for the prison service. So it's very, and it's all on trust. There's no bars or anything, razor wire, nothing. And it's a 5,000 acre place. So I started there. A friend of mine bought me an iPhone. And I started writing stuff and then mailing myself. So it was all saved in the clouds, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was going to say it could easily have been wiped or confiscated.
Absolutely.
And then all the work you did.
Yeah.
And then did you do a lot of writing in the prison?
I did. And I learned to write there. I hated writing. I mean, I'm from the bush. I'm a bushman. So, yeah, it was a brand new thing. And I posted a few of those on Facebook and that, mm-hmm. and the response was unbelievable.
Yeah.
People said, I didn't know you could write. And then I thought, and a lot of people offered to write my book for me. And it's not the same. And no. I wanted my voice to come through.
Yes. And I think it does. This, and I mean this, by the way, as a compliment. It has a kind of raw energy, this book.
Okay.
You know you're not reading Shakespeare.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's an honesty and which struck me as being very... I mean, it couldn't have been written by anyone else. It had to be written by you.
Thanks. When I wrote it, I wanted people to feel what I've went through, not just to try and visualize it. And when you can get across what you actually went through in the feeling, then I think you've got it.
And the little sketches, did you do those?
I did them all, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Gosh, the artist in you coming out.
Well, yeah.
And not the the wild man from the bush.
Yeah.
But then, did you write the book as a sort of therapeutic, cathartic thing, or is it written to inspire people?
I wanted the truth to be told. Mm. That was the one thing. And I thought the best way to do it, I'm not going to win in the courts because it's too corrupt.
Yeah.
So let me tell my story and get the truth out there. And then my motivational speaking has a therapeutic feeling to it.
I'm sure.
The more I talk about it, the more I release. And Sandra, my girlfriend, has really helped me in my spiritual path to overcome a lot of that.
So your spiritual life survived and is very much intact.
Absolutely. And since I met her, she's a great Christian. And when we pray and stuff, it works. Mm-hmm. And it's done wonders for us.
So as we draw near, I mean, we could carry on for a while because this incarceration thing sounds so horrifying that I cannot imagine what a nightmare must be.
Yeah.
Compared, and we use words so easily, don't we? That's Absolutely. The worst day of my life. That's the worst thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah.
But then there are things that take it to the next level.
Yeah.
Which you wonder, and did you ever think you wouldn't survive? Or you?
No.
Did you always think, I'm going to be okay?
I think it was probably my boarding school time and during the war, the survival thing, and your resilience was built up. And then I learned about gratitude in prison, where I learned to be grateful for what we have and what we've achieved and who we are in life, instead of worrying about things we don't have, you know. And I think we spend too much time on that. And people, I find, create their own prisons out of prison. Mm. Sour business partnerships, badly selected careers, being obsessed with money and ambition in the corporate world, unhappy marriages even. And when you're taken out of that, you have everything taken away, you see that where you were actually in prison too at one time, mm-hmm. In the past life.
Gosh.
Yeah.
And you're a happy chappy now, are
you? I'm very, very happy. I have a beautiful little grandson and another little one on the way from my daughter. Yeah. So.
And your family have always believed you were innocent, I presume.
Absolutely.
And it's never been declared in the courts that you were not guilty.
No, they won't do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I just wanted to mention as well what my children went through.
Mm.
They were 16 and 18 when I went in. And the trauma they went through in that 10 years after that was hell.
And
I've always been extremely close to my kids, and I still am. And my son is here in Cape Town, and my daughter runs my affairs in Zimbabwe. And I operate out of Johannesburg.
Oh, so you still have links to Zimbabwe?
Yes, I do. I have property there, and she runs that property. It's a big player, 34 acres in the city. When things are good, I bought some beautiful land there.
Do you not feel tense about going back or apprehensive when you go back into the country?
No, I've got great hope for Zimbabwe. It's really going to take off.
Are you happy with the election that's just happened?
Absolutely.
Who's got into power, I mean?
Yeah, no, I think it's the only way forward.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I think any other decision would have ended up more turmoil.
Yeah.
But I think it'll smooth out and everything will take off there. And it's a beautiful country with so much potential.
So I've never been there, but anyway.
Okay, yeah.
Well, Rusty, we have to end it there. Before you choose your last piece of music, tell us how you get hold of the book. Is it in bookshops or how do you get hold of it?
Not yet. I'm working with Exclusive Books and Kum Bookstores. But you can get it on my website.
Oh, do you have a website?
Right now, yeah. Okay, www.beatingchains.com.
Oh, the title of the book is the website.
Beating, not breaking, beating chains.
Ah.
And it's about victory over injustice. And you can order online.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I have the DVD of my keynote, which is a 52-minute keynote speech.
On your website?
On my website too, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just repeat, it's www.beatingchains.com.
Beating chains.
I nearly said breaking. It's very clever that you chose the word beating and not
beating,
breaking.
Yeah.
So there you are. Beating Change is the title of the book. Victory Over Injustice is the subtitle. The author, Rusty Labuschagne, with an extraordinary story, which thank you for sharing part of it with us. I mean,
my pleasure.
A life, as you say, 10 years out of your life. But what's your last piece of music, Rusty?
Is Like Jesus Does by Eric Church.
And this is a reflection of your Christian side.
Absolutely.
To share with us.
Yeah.
Rusty, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Rodney. And all strength to your arm.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm a long gone waiting song on vinyl. I'm a back row sinner at a tent revival. She believes in me like she believes her Bible. Loves me like Jesus does. I'm a left foot leaning on a souped up Chevy. I'm a good old boy drinking whiskey and rye on. But she carries me when my sins make me heavy, and loves me like Jesus does. All the crazy in my dreams, both my broken wings, every single piece of everything I am, and she knows the man I am. She forgives me when I can't. devil man, no, he don't stand a chance. But she loves me like Jesus does. I always thought she'd give up on me one day. Wash your hands of me, leave me staring down some runway. But I thank God each night and twice on Sunday. She loves me like Jesus does. All the crazy in my dreams, both my broken wings, every single piece of who I am. Yeah, she knows the man I am. She forgives me when I can't. And the devil man, no, he don't have a prayer. She loves me like Jesus does. Yeah, she knows the man I am. She forgives me when I can't. That devil man, he don't stand a chance. She loves me like Jesus does. I'm a long gone wailing song on vinyl.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This December, something extraordinary is coming to Cape Town. Experience the global phenomenon Matilda the Musical, inspired by the magic of Roald Dahl, live on stage at Artscape. The New York Post says, believe the hype. Don't miss the musical of the decade, proudly brought to you by Peter Turin and GWB Entertainment in association with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Be a genius. Book now.